Anyway, that said, going back to Rob Verbier, I thought it was a very good segue from looking at the kind of, if you like, the physical, the neuroscience, the cognitive science of what happens in our perception and how it kind of shows to us that things don't exist in the way they appear. And then it kind of segues into more the territory of where we're trying to go, and that's to, you know, how does this relate to our sense of identity, our sense of self, our feelings, and how we interpret that world. You know, by analogy, it's sort of going across. Now, I thought it was also good the last one of Rob's, you know, looking for the holes in our sort of conceptual ideas about ourself, using the idea of our roles, you know, saying, well, it is just a role dependent on all sorts of causes, conditions, and social agreement. It's not that we actually have to identify with it or be defined by it and feel that that's us, or that even when we're sitting on the toilet, and well, as he rather skillfully pointed out, even if we wanted to, we probably couldn't do that. But we tend to go in that direction. And then I thought his one about the retreat was really good, because it's sort of where we are now. So it reminded me of a good approach to retreat, and one that also relates back to MIPAM's instructions on meditation. Is anybody familiar with Ajahn Brahm? He's an Australian monk in the Thai forest, Theravada tradition of Ajahn Chah. And he's quite well known now and spent quite a bit of time over here. And he wrote some time ago a very, very good book on the jhanas. He's a very good meditation teacher. And he sums his approach to meditation up. And retreat with a slogan, of course, and the slogan is relax to the max.
Relax.
Relax to the max.
To the max.
That's the way to approach retreat. If you feel yourself tightening up, or that, you know, something appears like it's a barrier or a restraint, there's probably nothing there but the way you feel about it. So if you can not suppress it or try to deny it, kind of allow it to be there, but relax around it, you might find it softens up a bit, and you think, oh, yeah. Anyway, relax the max. Thought it was rather good. So I wanted to go back to the, if you like, the cognitive sciencey bit, and then come back again to the internal. And then I think when we've done that today, we can then return to the structure of His Holiness, and get into the appreciation of dependent arising, the way things are dependent upon one another, because this one's really important to understand emptiness. Because that's where we're going to go next. But emptiness is not nothingness, of course. Well, a really good way to understand it is to really, by coming through this route, get an understanding of emptiness and dependent arising being synonymous. They're one and the same thing. So that's why it's worth the journey, I think. Anyway, we'll see how we go. So going back a bit to the illusions, the blind spot one, which is very effective, this one, it sort of shows you that it's not just that the star disappears, but there's a blind spot, a discontinuity in perception, in sight, that we make up for. So we see it not as a hole in the paper, or a nothing, or a blurred fuzzy edge, but as white paper. that gets put in there, you know, and it's an illusion, but it exists. But is it like that? Does it exist in the way it appears? No, it doesn't. So worth thinking about that. So it kind of demonstrated to us that we're not aware that there are parts of the visual field which we cannot see, and the continuity of our field of vision is in that way illusory. It's an illusion. So there are similar analogues covering the other senses, as I was saying, with sound, smell, taste, touch. In fact, there's one I'll do it, but I don't want to extend another session. I want to get back on track with this. But it's some very interesting things that started with people who were looking at visual reality, you know, visual reality things where you put these things on and you're going about in a visual reality. And they were interested to see if they could simulate out-of-the-body experiences using virtual reality. And they did indeed, by having you in virtual reality, in identifying with a body, yeah, as your own, and then when virtual reality, someone rubbed across the back of the shoulder, you'd feel it on the back of your own shoulder. Anyway, it's a very good article. It was in the New Yorker. I might share that rather than go into a lot of detail with it, but virtual reality does offer quite a lot of very interesting, exciting possibilities, because it's one thing to hear these things, but if you experience it, much as we did with this, then you think, you kind of get it in a much more direct and experiential way. So there are similar analogues applying to the other senses, some good ones with sound, where we join up the dots and hear something that's not actually there. So it's really a matter of kind of trying to be present to your own experience, because you might see things or note phenomena, or in your own perceptions say, maybe there's a discontinuity, what's going on and why? And that's fascinating, because you're actually then present to what's going on and it's coming out of your own experience. If you have an inclination, but it's not necessary, you can study illusions a bit when you get the chance and look into contemporary neuroscience and cognitive science to understand more about the nature of our experience. And you know, we don't, if you're a, you know, geek or a nerd, you can go there, PhD if you like, but most of us can deal with new scientists and stuff like that and think about it through. Depends on your level of interest, and it's not essential, but sometimes it's worth doing just to. So what does the non-Buddhist or the non-me mind think about it? You know, how's it go? What's their evidence for? What's not? It's not a bad approach to save us just being in a bubble created by our own beliefs and just going for all of that which confirms our prejudices rather than something that might challenge them. So it's a good idea. So what we've inferred from the ideas and analogies we've considered so far, that things don't exist in the way they appear to us. The important thing for us in all of this, you know, for all the bylines and philosophical discussion, all the rest of it, is does it convince us, does it bring any conviction that this idea that the way things appear to us is not the way they exist? Because that's really the purpose of it. That it's to try and move from that just being, I get it intellectually, to thinking, that is the way it is. It's true. But not just because somebody else says so, but because you can demonstrate it in your own experience. Yeah, it can be, but then I might say, well, I have an intuition or an instinct. It might be right, it might be wrong, I don't know. If it's really, really strong, then somebody else might challenge it and say, on what basis, Roy? But I think, so if you're saying, well, say in this example, well, yeah, it's obvious to me that the way things appear is not the way they are, then actually, in a way, that's enough for you. But many people aren't convinced. And if I start then talking about emptiness, and they say, oh, but how's that? I say, well, things are not as they appear. And they say, well, why not? So all of this is relative too, no? So, yeah, I agree. If you've got a gut feel or an instinct, or once you kind of really see something for yourself, I might hear an idea and I might think, oh, yeah, I understand it intellectually, but it kind of stays there. But if I have an experience which demonstrates it to me, then I think, oh, yeah, that if I knock it about a bit and test it, that's the way it is. And then I might subsequently just say, yeah, I know that that's an illusion. Yeah. And, or I might see something I've not seen before and just have a gut feel for it being a particular way. But then I need to test the gut feel a bit, don't I? If it's, oh yeah, in fact, I think the idea that things do exist in the way they appear is happening just like that. You know, the assumption.
That's almost when you know what you feel.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The way we just assume that things are like that is coming, I think, just out of there. But that in the past has also been reinforced by upbringing, conditioning, education, past experience. It was like learning to drive a car or whatever else. Well, once you've learned to drive the car, any instruction manual on how to do it seems voluminous and unnecessary. It's pretty easy, isn't it? But if you're the other side, then it all seems like, can I ever possibly do it? Is a car going to go off and hit the wall or whatever? I'm so instinctive that you can do it while talking, half listening to the radio and monitoring a few signs on the way, no? Almost on automatic pilot. Oh, that's a bit dangerous. That's an interest. That whole thing about gut feel and instinct applies in all sorts of different ways around it. So if we're sort of moving to say, okay, yeah, I think I'm not just getting the idea, but I'm really getting an understanding and an experiential feel for the fact that things don't exist in the way they appear, it's still good to kind of challenge it a bit. So if I was going to play devil's advocate, I'd say, okay, we've inferred from the ideas and analogies we've kind of considered so far that, yeah, this is kind of, you know, evidence that things don't exist in the way they appear. But if I wanted to play devil's advocate with it, then I could say, well, Roy, it's very impressive, but in actual fact, all you've done is point out a few rare exceptions in the discontinuity of our perception in one sensory organ. But in actual fact, most of the time, it's okay, and we perceive the world pretty much as it is. It's a fair challenge. I mean, nobody has made it, but you could have done. Yeah. It's a fair go. So what would I kind of respond to that? And trying to think of it from a Buddhist perspective, you know, I'd be saying, well, okay, but there's a suspicion that what's been demonstrated with this, someone might could even take the piss of it, couldn't they? Except we had to cover up one eye and we had to do this. It's no wonder it. But I'm saying you can't deny that although we've had to do this and this, it has uncovered something very interesting that when it reaches that point, there's not a hole in the paper, there's white paper. No, that's not, it's kind of not the way it is. So, but I take the point that it may be seen to be exceptional. So if they are kind of rare and isolated cases in our perception, and we do actually perceive the world more or less the way it is, as a challenge to the idea that it doesn't exist in the way it appears, I'd say, well, we did have a fairly firm conviction about the continuity of the visual field, which this and other considerations made us think, oh, it's not quite like that. Well, we've got a similar, very firm conviction about the continuity of our consciousness. You know, we think that's continuous in a way that the visual field is demonstrably not. No? So, to be bold, the spatial and temporal continuity of our consciousness, looking at it from this perspective, is a grand illusion. It's a magic trick played upon us by our own minds. So, why might that be? How am I going to suggest that? I'd go back to, in the same way when we were actually looking at the visual discontinuities, there's this idea that there's a screen-like nature to the retina, and that it's continuous and all of that. And maybe we think that somehow there's some mental screen on which the mental image is projected, right? But if we go back to thinking about the screen-like nature of the retina, that analogy, we know it has blind spots. And there's another one that we haven't yet explored, and that's, in addition, in the centre of the retina, and it's easier to describe by what we see than by the physiology of the eye, with a lot of Latin terms, but in effect, at the centre of our visual field, the resolution there is some 10 times higher than at the edges. But as I'm looking at you now, and including peripheral vision, it doesn't seem like that to me. It's not sort of all wonderful, bright and clear in the middle, and blurred and fuzzy at the edges. Yeah. But in actual fact, it is like that. So how does the illusion of continuity in the retinal field, if you like, the visual field, occur? It's because the eyes are moving about all the time, tracking objects, movements, things. And even if we wanted to do shamatha with an external object and fixed our gaze on it, there would be minute movements of the eye that could be measured all the time. So what's happening is it's looking at all the different parts of everything all the time, and the gaps are being made up by the same illusion of continuity that creates the white paper there. Yeah. So the temporal continuity of consciousness seems to rest on similar shaky foundations. Yeah. And one of the ways of throwing this up is, I think, what cognitive scientists now call the time gap experience. And we're all familiar with it, that even if we don't drive, but it's most, if we all drive, then you'll most notice it if you do a long drive up the motorway from London to the Land of Joy. When you get here, you suddenly realise that there was a person who wasn't unconscious at the wheel, in the same way you describe somebody who is out cold. But there are whole tracks of the journey that you've no memory of, that you can't describe, and yet someone was at the wheel driving and doing all that stuff. So there's a time gap experience. You can have it on a train if it's a long enough, you know, if you've just got a long journey where you think, well, yeah, I know I did that, I can't remember all the kind of, there's a time gap experience, yeah. If you're present to it and you read a lot, it happens when you read too. The gaps keep getting filled in. So it appears continuous. It appears there's a continuity, you know, there's a if we look at what's actually going on, it's this kind of silly, yeah. What we're doing is exactly the same as we go to the fridge, yeah. We open the door, and there's a light on, and we close the door. And then somebody says, "Is there a light on in your fridge?" You say, "Yeah, it's on all the time." If you doubt me, go check it. Every time you open the door, it's on. That's what's going on. It's that simple, or that complicated, if you want to cash it out in scientific terms. Yeah, it is just like that. So I'd argue these cognitive illusions are not just rare and isolated quirks. There's a fundamental illusion right at the centre of our consciousness and our lives, because our consciousness, something we all seem to know as a continuous, smoothly flowing experience without any holes or gaps, is actually nothing like that. Again, it's, you know, how the moving picture creates the illusion of motion. So our consciousness is discontinuous in the extreme, but doesn't appear to us to be so. It doesn't exist in the way that it appears. And there are very good reasons for that, and there's nothing wrong with the appearance as long as we recognise that it is an appearance. It doesn't exist in the way that it appears. And if I go back to the Pali Canon with the Buddha, now, when I first read this, I thought, oh, but having come a long distance, then going into these areas over a long period of time, I thought, oh God, yes, what I thought was a bit of a rather bold and poetic gesture appears to be true. The Buddha said, "Consciousness is a magic show, a juggler's trick entire." It may be just like that. So, I think I said, was it yesterday or this morning? Time gap experience, there we are. Or maybe dementia. Let's move on to consider Discourse on Foam, the Frena Sutta. I mentioned that one. So the best thing I can do is read that first. It's not all of it. It's not that long, but it's the input. The whole sutra's not that long, but I just want to read the bit that's relevant to us. He said, "On one occasion, the Blessed One was staying among the Ayodhyans on the banks of the Ganges River. There he addressed the monks. 'Monks, suppose that a large glob of foam were floating down this Ganges River, and a man with good eyesight were to see it, observe it, and appropriately examine it. To him, seeing it, observing it, and appropriately examining it, it would appear empty, void, without substance. For what substance would there be in a glob of foam?'" A bit like the clouds we were talking about. "In the same way, a monk sees, observes, and appropriately examines any form that is past, future, or present, internal or external, blatant or subtle, common or sublime, far or near. To him, seeing it, observing it, and appropriately examining it, it would appear empty, void, without substance. For what substance would there be in form?" Now suppose that in the autumn, when it's raining in fat, heavy drops, a water bubble were to appear and disappear on the water, and a man with good eyesight were to see it, observe it, and appropriately examine it. To him, seeing it, observing it, and appropriately examining it, it would appear empty, void, without substance. For what substance would there be in a water bubble? In the same way, a monk sees, observes, and appropriately examines any feeling that is past, future, or present, internal or external, blatant or subtle, common or sublime, far or near. To him, seeing it, observing it, and appropriately examining it, it would appear to be empty, void, without substance. For what substance would there be in feeling. So the Buddha's kind of here claiming that all matter is insubstantial as foam. Not a bad approximation. Now on the first one he's talking about form. So it's not a bad approximation of how contemporary physics views the constitution of matter. You know, we've had a little look at that, but just to take it, you know, a little bit deeper, a little bit clearer, any object can be broken down or analysed into molecules, the molecules that constitute it, which in turn can be broken down into atoms. Yeah? And the atoms can further be broken down into a tiny nucleus, and that tiny nucleus is a nucleus of protons and neutrons, and they're circled by a cloud of electrons. Now, their scale, at that scale, relative to their size, the distance between the nucleus of an atom and the electrons is astonishing. It's huge, you know, at that scale. There was one of this early 20th century very famous physicists, Ernest Rutherford. He famously said that trying to locate the nucleus of an atom is like searching for a fly in a cathedral. So the electrons surround a tiny bit of matter surrounded by vast amounts of empty space. So the neutrons and protons can be broken down yet further into an array of subatomic particles. And then there's still clearly the subatomic particles have parts, but it's now getting so infinitesimally small that it's at the limits of the ability to even indirectly see it or measure it. So theory comes into play, and there's the thing I think that's even made the tabloid newspapers, string theory. So string theory is arguing that that can be further broken down and explained by a string, which I have to kind of quote here. A tiny oscillating loop about 100 billion billion billion, 10 to the power of 20 times smaller than the atomic nucleus, and that seems unlikely to be the end of the line. Yeah, maybe there's no end to the line. It doesn't have to be. Which, that's interesting in itself. What's that saying about matter? Mm-hmm. If we go back for another kind of look at the Frenna Sutta, to that second paragraph, and relate it by analogy to our feelings, whether that's sensations or feelings as emotions, but I think in this case he was probably talking about Vedana, but it could go for either. As the Buddha himself did, it's worth considering that kind of conceptualizing, we may have an idea when we think those pair of opposites, again, pleasure and pain. Yeah, we all want pleasure and we don't want pain. You know, back to the Four Noble Truths and all of that. As it appears, we think, oh, there's two different words labelling two different things. Huh? Maybe even underlined by some sort of analogy with atomic theory, I don't know, but there we are. We just do that. They're two different things, pleasure and pain, opposites, polar opposites. Well, it might be a mistake. You know, they might not exist as they appear. They could be considered not as two different things, but that one is just the absence of the other. And interestingly, from our point of view, Tsongkhapa, founder of the Gelug tradition, back in the 13th to 14th century, in his Lamrim Chenmo, Great Exposition of the Stages of the Path, suggests just that. He says, moreover, your current pleasant feelings, which cause attachment to grow, mostly arise only upon the relief of suffering. Pleasure does not exist naturally independently of the removal of suffering. For example, if you suffer because of too much walking, a pleasant state of mind arises when you sit down. Then, as the earlier intense suffering fades, pleasure appears to arise gradually. Yet sitting is not naturally pleasant, because if you sit too long, suffering arises again, just as before. Now, I won't bore you with it, but there's some very interesting science looking at fruit flies that seems to say, oh, there's more than, you know, an observational or conjectural basis for that. So again, you know, going back to things not existing as they appear, yet we very often assume they are. We assume that these things are polar opposites, or that it's all this way, or that it's all another way, when very often it's just that way in one circumstance because the causes and conditions are like that. But in another, it may be like this. In a third, it may be like that. Yeah. And the pairs of opposites may not be irreconcilable, inherently existing opposites. Yeah. So I think that's enough to get us where we want to go next, to say what's being pointed to here is that perhaps we are all living in a universe that is totally and utterly dependent, that you can't pull one part of it out separately and have the rest go on. The whole thing would fall apart. And whatever it is that we can point to, we can't find anything that's singular, permanent, partless, existing from its own side, not related to anything else, totally self-sufficient. There's the idea that there can be something like that is a complete fantasy. Yet, that's a kind of assumption we make a lot of the time. So when we start to talk about emptiness, the idea is, what's it empty of? That one. Does that mean there's nothing there? No. It just means the world's not the way we thought it was. It's a dependent arising, and that's, you know, right back and consistent with the teaching of the Buddha. Because of that, this arises. Did God create the world? No, it's a network of causes and conditions. It's dependent origination, conditioned co-production, like that. Because it's not possible in that sort of universe for something to be separate or completely isolated or on its own or existing from its own side, just popped up. No, can't happen. But insofar as we assume that things are like that, more importantly, we're like that, you know, we're under the sway of an illusion that things exist the way they appear. And when our sense of self arises, and it's strong, you know, whether that's for because it's very pleasurable and we really like it, or because we really don't like it, that's when we feel it strongest. There's a lot of time we walk around, we don't have a very strong sense of self. Just doing what you do, walking down the corridor, going to the toilet, whatever. If you do something really well, and there's a lot of emotion involved, and people are patting you on the back, and you think, wow, it's really good. You've got this kind of sense of self. Or, yeah, I've always liked to do that. It's really good. I'm good at that. Or if someone accuses us, which is the traditional example, of something we didn't do, how dare they? I didn't do that. There's a really strong sense of self. But it kind of pops up in dependence on those causes and conditions. It breaks down into its parts. What are those parts? Thoughts, emotions, sensations, memories, ideas of ourselves. And then when it's gone, it subsides. It disappears. Like the foam, like the bubble. Yet, if you say, oh, Roy, have you got a continuity of sense of self? Well, of course I have. But I suspect the same thing that's going on there is as what's going on with my sense organs the center of my consciousness, the gaps are being invented for me, so it appears continuous. So there is no singular, permanent, partless, continuous, inherently existing from its own side, Roy. That one is a completely fantasized way of existing. Does that mean I don't exist? No, here I am, blathering on about it. But if I believe in the former one, then that's the one that causes me and other people all sorts of problems. Yeah. You know, whether that's me damaging other people or me saying to myself, oh, I couldn't possibly do that. I'm not that sort of person. I'm not like that. Or somebody throws hot water over me by mistake and I say, oh, you idiot. It might have been idiotic, unmindful behaviour, but they are not an inherently existing idiot. You know, for all I know, they may have a PhD. I might thoroughly dislike someone, but their mother loves them. Their wives, do you see what I'm getting at? So when we talk about the emptiness of the self, that's where it's going. But it's sort of recognition that we don't exist in the way that we appear, but we arise in any given circumstances on the basis of the causes and conditions. And if they're not there, then it doesn't happen like that. Yeah. We know where the buttons are, what makes us angry, but if they're not there, then we don't get angry, we don't feel ourselves in that way. Yeah. If the causes and conditions for me being here doing this and all the rest of it carry on, then I carry on doing it. If they stop, and they stop in any one of a number of, you know, really important ways, I'm dead. I no longer carry on. Or the body might survive, but the personality might disintegrate because the plaques in the brain no longer support the causes and conditions for it to continue. And then people say, oh, how terrible, we lost him, but there was nobody there to lose. You know, it's sort of like, so think about the suffering that may be associated with the one perspective as opposed to the other. It's just a glimpse through there, yeah? Like that. Anyway, so that's where we're going to go. But I've lost any thoughts. I've lost a bit track of the time in losing myself in that. We're coming up to 4:15. Oh, yes, we're just about on time. We're not far off. Going for, but there's a little bit of, you know, 2 or 3 minutes if there are any comments or questions. Well, I suppose it's in MIPAM's instructions, in a way. It's a good place to go for that. Because, of course, he or anybody else, you know, as a great master of meditation, can say, just sit there and relax your mind. And then you might be saying it to me, and I might say, what do you mean? Where is the mind? What do you mean by the mind? What am I supposed to be relaxing? I haven't got a clue. Okay, draw the awareness. What's that? Well, you know, you have an awareness of things. You're cognizant. You know they're there. You know, it's the difference between being alive or dead, asleep or awake. Although there's clearly something going on when we're asleep, because all our systems are kept going on an autonomous nervous system. If we don't die in the night, we wake up in the morning. But we know what we mean when we say, if we're either awake, not dead, as it were, then there just is experience. That's what it is to be alive. There's a vivacity that generates that. And it doesn't have any attributes in terms of being, it doesn't have form, it doesn't have shape. It doesn't have colour, it doesn't smell, it doesn't have sound, it doesn't, you can't touch it, it's not tactile, it doesn't have any location. You can't come up with it as you might some sort of material thing. You know, as I often say, if you saw us open and said, let's find the mind, we ain't going to find it. So that's where it is. And MIPAM's sort of saying, okay, if you If you can't do that, then just for a moment, think about drawing your attention or awareness into an empty area in the heart. Yeah? And then just rest there. But then later on, he says, well, actually, it isn't there. It's just a way of saying, okay, if you've got no peg on this to get the thing started, do it this way. Draw the attention into the heart, the empty space at the heart. But in actual fact, it's not there. If there should be a mind, it ought to be located in the body, but it ain't. And in actual fact, this is just the same as leaving it alone. And you think, oh, and there's kind of a centered. Oh, and yeah, what am I supposed to be doing? I'm just letting things settle as if I'm going to sleep. But I'm not going to go to sleep. I'm going to try and remain alert, sort of like that. But, so there is nothing there. There's nothing that has any independent existence. The sensory experience and the consciousness are dependent on me being born, being alive, having a body, living in the universe and the world that I do. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's got, there's nothing in there that I can see has some kind of self-existing or independent existence. That's there's nothing there I can see, whichever way I look at it, that's not dependent on something else. But think about it, yeah, and come back to it. If it's good, it'll stay and mature like wine. Anyway, so